Hello, my name is Eddie LeSueur, and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM FM 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at wpvmfm.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, and our guests take an in-depth and informative look into holistic, evidence-based approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, go to amindfulemergence.com. And with that, good evening, Margaret. How are you doing this evening, Martin Luther King Day?
Hi, I'm doing well, yeah.
Okay. And this is show number 57. We just keep on rolling.
Rolling along.
So with that, I'd like to introduce our guest for this week, who is Jessica Ringel, who we're very happy to bring into the studio. And Jessica is a psychotherapist and author and adventurer and multi-talented, multifaceted person. And the theme this week will be finding forgiveness and compassion for oneself and others. So with that, welcome to WPVM, Jessica.
Hey, thanks, Eddie and Margaret. Really appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah. So finding forgiveness and compassion for oneself and others. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what we're going to be focusing on this weekend, or not this weekend, but this evening.
Sure. You know, I'm going to talk a lot about my own personal journey. I'm going to talk about some of the things that have worked for me and what seems to work for others that I've been working with over the past, almost 30 years of being in practice, working with people in addiction and with other co-occurring mental health issues.
All right. And before we go any further, you have recently published a book called Making It Up. And this is pretty exciting. Your first book?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And this is available now?
Yes, it is. And it's available on Amazon.
Okay.
And locally through me. And people can go to my Facebook page, Making It Up, and they can also go to my website, which is jessicaringel.com, and they can push the little red button. It'll take them to Amazon, or they can go to Amazon directly.
And that's R-I-N-G-L-E.
That's right. Rhymes with single.
And we'll talk more about the book a little bit later.
Great.
I was just going to ask about the title, Making
It
Up.
Go ahead.
It seems like we're all just making up the story of our lives as we go along, doing the best we can, and maybe taking a step forward, a couple of steps back. I'm just wondering if that is your idea about the title of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all kind of making up our reality as we go along, like you said. And also, we tend to, in this book, characters in the book were really very surprised to find that their history wasn't at all what they really thought it was. So they'd been making up things the whole time and had to readjust and reconfigure that reality.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your background a little bit. Where did you grow up, Jessica?
Well, I'm adopted and actually adopted by crazy people. and I can speak very freely about them because they're gone. Mm. But anyway, I was adopted in Ohio, and later on went to Denver and spent a lot of my, you know, junior high, high school, and college years in Denver. And then I branched off from there and began traveling around.
Yeah, you talk about on your website, you describe yourself as a, incurable rolling stone, a passion for wanderlust. How did that generate?
Well, I just, whenever I would be in a certain place, I would find myself eventually becoming kind of restless. And feeling as though, you know, what I had come to learn there was at an end. And then I would move on. So I moved on from place to place. And now I feel like I've kind of rolled to a stop, as I say.
Found a home?
Yeah, I think so.
That's something I can relate to. I spent a lot of years traveling around. And when I got to Asheville, it's like, I just want to sink my feet into the ground and stay here. It wears on you after a while. At least it did for me.
It does.
Yeah. So you're very open about the fact that you're in recovery. Let's talk a little bit about that transformation. Sounds like you had a difficult childhood from your comment early.
Yes.
How did that impact you and lead to substance use disorder?
Well, I think, you know, basically, you know, like Gabor Mate has said, you know, addiction really is a response to trauma. It's also a response to pain and suffering and a lack of connection and isolation. So, and also a deep-seated shame. So I think it's really, you know, viewed that way, it's really understandable why folks that go through trauma end up using drugs or food or, you know, a multiplicity of things, you know, to kind of assuage that deep-seated hurt.
And when did you really get lost in drugs?
I started drinking when I was like 10.
Wow.
And by the time I was 15, I was an IV drug user and pretty off to the races.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you go to school back then? And
yeah, somehow or another, I managed to get through high school and to get through a couple years of college before I dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
And my decision to drop out was really based on my adopted mother was an alcoholic, and codependency, of course, was rife in my life, and I was always trying to fix her and other people. That was kind of my mission, even as a kid. You know, that was my thing, was to be the one that people came to and talked to, and I listened, and I'd give advice. And so, you know, I was trying to fix Mom, couldn't fix Mom, and I thought, well, I was, you know, majoring in psychology, and I just thought, what a joke. I can't even help my own mother. So I dropped out, and I didn't go back to school for many years.
What did you do after you dropped out?
That's when I really began traveling.
Okay. Yeah. Where'd you start?
Well, let's see. I left Denver, and I went to New Mexico and lived in this ghastly place. Woo! I lived in a desert, you know, in every sense, you know, metaphorically and literally, and a little town called Grants, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm, I know where it is.
Mm-hmm. And back in those days, that place I never saw. It was a desert, but it had been irrigated, and it used to be the carrot capital, and then it became the uranium mining capital. And so all the industry was around, you know, going into the mines, or all these guys in mines, and it was a really rough place.
What were you doing there?
I worked in a sawmill.
Oh, really?
Yep, worked in a sawmill.
Part of the industrial proletariat.
Yeah, definitely. I was a worker.
So were you a hippie chick?
I'd say kind of.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really very politically motivated, because I was really too into my own drug use, and I was broke, and I was, you know, just trying to survive.
Yeah. So how'd you get clean? What was the turning point that shift for you?
Yeah, that turning point came, you know, I'd already...
Moment of clarity.
Yeah, that moment of clarity was, I left New Mexico, I went to Alaska, I was living up in Alaska, I tried to get sober and clean up there, and that didn't work, I was white knuckling it. It was misery, and I was hearing voices, and I was going crazy. And so eventually, I ended up in Seattle, and a phone call to my dad, my adopted dad, who I had very little contact with growing up, was the turning point, because he started bragging on his stepchildren, particularly his stepdaughters, who were married and they were having kids and they were living a ordinary, you know, normal life, which was far from what I was living. And it did something to me. Mm-hmm. And there was just this overwhelming sense of shame and just like disgust with my life, and I wasn't doing anything. You know, the only job I'd had was as a dishwasher. It was the only one I could have because I could wear rubber and stand in water because I was incontinent, and my alcoholism was pretty advanced even at a young age like that. So it was shame. It really kind of drove me to the rooms.
So you came into 12-step recovery.
Mm-hmm, I did. Mm-hmm.
And that was a while ago.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, we're not going to date you.
No.
That's up to you. Sounds like you got sober in your 20s.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So you're a songwriter,
mm-hmm.
A singer, yep, a poet. Were you creating these things back then?
Well, I always wrote. And I always sang, and I made my first dollar singing in a bar when I made my first dollar singing Hava Nagila.
Really?
In a Dayton bar. Yeah. And then I was known as Little Bit, and so at the age of 9, I would don a Beatle wig and get up on the bar and sing and get tips.
Wow.
So I started my singing career at a very young age.
I guess so.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. And then I played in bands all through high school and college. And
As a singer, or did you play an instrument as well?
I play an instrument, but I'm really more of a front person singer.
Okay.
And songwriter, yeah.
And you're still doing that?
I'm still doing that. I don't do it, you know, I am not really plugged into the music community around here yet. But
you lived in Nashville for a while.
I did.
And how did that go?
Well, that was 13 years of banging my head up against the music business, but it really was a great school.
I bet you got some good stories.
I do. And they're going to be part of another book I'm writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But during that time in Nashville, you were sober.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was. I went back to school and in my mid-30s and finished my college degree, my undergrad. And then I took another hiatus before I went back at almost 50 and got my master's degree.
So you are an LCAS, Licensed Clinical Addiction Specialist, and an LPC, a Licensed Professional Counselor. And do you want to share where you work, or you rather?
Sure. Yeah, I don't mind saying. I'm working for the state at one of the 3 state-run inpatient drug alcohol rehabs, and we primarily work with folks who don't have money, who are homeless, and who are very often also what we call have co-occurring disorders.
And explain what that means for our listeners who don't understand.
Yeah, we used to treat mental illness and substance abuse separately, which is just crazy. And now we don't. So co-occurring just means that you have more than one illness. You might have a mental illness along with your substance abuse.
Because a lot of people who've been diagnosed with various illnesses such as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and depression have just turned to drugs to self-medicate.
Sure.
Yeah. But it's no different than anyone who's gone through any kind of pain. You were talking about Gabor Mate before, and you know, what he says is people ask the wrong question. They say, why the addiction?
Yeah.
And the question should be, why the pain?
Yeah, what happened to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So,
and that's also where, you know, compassion kind of comes
in. Yeah. Well, that's what I want to turn to. You know, you came up, as our guests do, we requested our guests come up with a theme that they want to talk about, and you picked finding forgiveness and compassion for oneself and others. And by the way, this is probably a good time to jump in and say, for those who have just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM-FM and WPVM-FM.org. And Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Jessica Ringel, who's an author and psychotherapist. And so why did that topic call to you, finding forgiveness and compassion for oneself and others?
Well, a common theme that I see that runs through a lot of folks that suffer with addiction and also mental illness is a sense of self-hate, you know, and a belief, a deep-seated belief that if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. And I really think that a lot of us suffer from attachment disorders, which, you know, really, you know, we talk about big T trauma, you know, which is, you know, obvious stuff like horrific neglect and sexual abuse and also physical abuse and combat, mm-hmm. anything like that, you know. But then there's the little T trauma, which is also just about as bad if you are you don't have a caregiver that's really invested or not able to be invested, really, you know, depressed, maybe mom isn't available, dad's emotionally cut off, and you don't really get that, you know, that human connection, and so you really feel empty. And so I think that leads us often, you know, that lack of, you know, really feeling connected and really feeling valued, really feeling important will take us into, you know, needing to medicate that in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, what I've seen in my own life in recovery and in the lives of the folks that I work with is it's really absolutely vital that they begin to find some kindness towards themselves.
Yeah,
and it breaks my heart when I talk to people who are in recovery, you know, and most of them are in early recovery, and you hear them talk about themselves in such self-loathing ways. Mm-hmm. And I can't quote directly, I'll have to change a word, but there was one young man who really believed he was a piece of dung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had been told that, he believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone really feels that way about themselves, what are their chances for really having successful long-term recovery, Jessica?
Well, it's really tough, you know, and I can say that as a person who was an Olympic self-hater, and it's taken me many, many, many years to get over that.
What are some of the things that you did? How did you go about this shift, this healing?
Well, I had probably about maybe 15 years and 11 years in, I cried every day.
When you say in, you mean
working in a 12-step
program.
Right. And back in the day that I came in, if you were depressed or if you were suffering and struggling with grief and loss, you weren't working the program.
Right.
You just weren't working the program. And you better work the steps and you better, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of abuse you got. And if you, you know, if you were struggling with grief and depression and loss, you were told to, you know, get off your pity pot and, you know, get off the cross. We need the lumber. You know, I was told that one time by a guy with a really thick Brooklyn accent. And, you know, there was very little compassion or kindness in the rooms.
And I think that was concurrent with just a general attitude towards people who use drugs, like the Get Tough.
Mm-hmm.
What was that program? Get Straight?
Scared Straight.
Scared Straight. The guys would go into prison and scream at people and all this kind of stuff.
Therapeutic communities.
That doesn't work.
It's terrible. And back in the day when I first started working with addicts and, you know, in counseling, you know, it was all about breaking denial and, you know, and actually all it did was just reinforce the shame and the self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've moved a long ways past that now, which is a good thing. And then fortunately in my own life, I moved, and you asked me what kind of did that for me. And what happened for me was I started meditating. And when I started meditating, I started to hear what I was saying to myself.
How does that work? Explain that a little bit.
Well, I started back in the 80s meditating because there was a guy, and he's gone now, but he's a pretty famous songwriter, and he was in the program, and he had a little group of us over at his house, and we sat zazen, and I knew nothing about that, you know, and so we sat, and that started me on the road, and I, you know, did that for a while, and then I would break off, and then I'd get back on, and then I met these teachers that were really into Zen, and I sat with them, and then it became a regular practice. So just sitting and watching and developing an observing part of myself was the thing. You know, just following your breath, just sitting and watching. And eventually, like I said, I started hearing what I was saying to myself. And once I could hear what I was saying, because it ran like a soundtrack at a low, very subliminal level all my life. Because not only, you know, did I have trauma, the folks that raised me were very critical people. So, you know, anything I did was criticized. So I internalized that, and I became my own worst critic, as we do. So finding out what I was saying, I then was able to start working with it.
So you're doing your meditation, you're watching your breath, and then you're noticing the thoughts that are going through your mind. And after a while, you start seeing the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And how important was it for you to understand that you didn't have to believe those thoughts?
That's key. And that was the part that was kind of missing. Because I was in a position where I was in a very rural area, and I wasn't making very much money, and I couldn't do therapy. So I was really trying to do therapy for myself. So I needed that help, which I eventually got. But it's very important to recognize that, you know, what lies that we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And not to believe those lies, to actually question.
Exactly.
Challenge those thoughts that are running through the background or the underneath. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first started to meditate, I had this sense that I was much bigger than my skin, you know, much bigger than my body. And I remember actually stopping meditation in order to look in the mirror to see if anything had changed externally. And of course, it didn't, but it was this internal sense or awareness that there's more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I did want to make a comment relevant to a point you made earlier when you were talking about how when you were in the rooms, as they say, going to meetings, and people were kind of just saying, hey, just get your act together kind of stuff. That's changed, hasn't it? Mm. There's more of an openness now in the rooms and understanding that we can ask for outside help.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot more.
Yeah.
There's still, depending on where you are, there's still some, you're just not, you know, you just don't believe in God enough, or you don't, you know, you're not doing this enough. And yeah, but yes, I think there's a lot more openness. And there's also more openness towards using medication, you know, if we need it.
Yeah, medically assisted treatment.
Mm-hmm. And antidepressants.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
To help us. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a program that we haven't had. This is program number 57, Jessica. But yet we've yet to have a guest on to talk about harm reduction.
Right.
And I think that's really important.
That's very important.
That's one of the areas that I'm exploring right now, is to find someone to come on and talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
So your meditation practice was rooted in Buddhist traditions,
right,
and Buddhist practice,
right,
and you're part of a meditation group now.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've been very, very lucky. Everywhere I've ever lived, even if it's been in the middle of nowhere, I've either started my own group and had people sitting with me, or I've been very fortunate to find teachers and a good sangha. That's what they call the community of people that get together and sit with one another and support one another's spiritual practice. And there's a group here in town, Asheville Insight Meditation, and I plugged in with them and have been sitting with them for the past three and a half years.
Mm-hmm. And done retreats with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Every time they have one, I'm there.
And why is that important?
Well, having an extended period where you are able to really kind of deepen your practice by being away and being in silence with other people and sitting for many hours a day actually helps you to get, you know, really, like I said, to deepen your practice. I think it's really essential to have those, you know, schedule a retreat or two at least a year.
And talking about compassion is really part of the Buddhist tradition, a big part. They talk about how it's like two wings of a bird. You have the wisdom and the compassion. So the wisdom is getting insights into how our minds work. You talked about that, starting to see what your thoughts are. And then you have the compassion side. Mm-hmm. And it really is important to take a compassionate approach through this, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we start looking at our minds, and I know for me, sometimes I go, oh, man, I don't know if I want to go in there alone.
Yeah, dangerous neighborhood.
It's pretty crazy sometimes. Yeah. And I've been meditating a long time, and sometimes I sit down, and it's like, I'm just caught up in obsessive thought.
Yeah.
But I just need to stop and go, okay.
Yeah.
That's just how it is today.
That's how it is.
It doesn't mean I suck as a meditator.
Right.
Doesn't mean I'm going to have a bad day.
No.
Yeah. And that's when I usually tell Margaret, I'm not doing very well today.
Yeah.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And well, I'll say the same thing. You know, I'm really, you know, not in a good place. I'm really struggling right now.
Yeah. So your program of recovery, and it's in decades now, is you work 12-step program, go to meetings, and all that's involved with that, and you also have a meditation practice. Mm-hmm. What else do you do to help make sure that you don't succumb back to that disease of addiction?
Well, I think it's really, you know, like Matei talks about, it is so important to have community. So, you know, really making sure that I don't isolate, making sure that I have healthy, fun, social activities with people, making sure that I have creative outlets, making sure that I rest, you know. I mean, it's a threefold program, really. You know, you want to work on the physical, you want to work on the spiritual, and you want to work on the emotional, mental. So, you know, having all that, and as a therapist, I'm very upfront about the fact that I'm in therapy. I think if you're going to do this work, you ought to be in therapy.
Yeah. Well, that's what our clinical supervisor told us. So, we have therapists.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very, very helpful.
I think there's a mistaken idea by some people who work in the field, as we say, who are in recovery and work in the field, that, well, you know, I'm spending all this time talking about recovery with my clients. You know, I'm getting help there. No.
No.
No, that's more stress.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to pause and take a musical break and do a station ID. And when we come back, let's talk about your book, Making It Up. And then also explore, I want to talk about, you went to Morocco with the Peace Corps. That's pretty cool. And some other stuff. But right now, I just want to remind our listeners, this is Eddie LeSure, and from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM, Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in an effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m., and Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m. for our rebroadcast, all our past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. You can easily locate these past shows by just selecting this program off the schedule at WPVMFM.org. It's listed Mondays at 7 p.m. And once you click on the show, you'll see all the past podcasts, really, is what they are. Listed, and you may find some other shows that are of interest to you. All our programs are made possible by A Mindful Emergence LLC, an Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, retreats, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. And you can look for them online at amindfulemergence.com, as well as on Facebook and LinkedIn. And this is WPVM FM 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. I've picked out a tune this week by Bonnie Raitt that kind of links up to the theme. It's called Sweet Forgiveness.
Look slow, it don't look
And there we have Bonnie Raitt and a title track from her album Sweet Forgiveness. Love mm-hmm. me some Bonnie Raitt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Jessica Ringel, and I want to turn now to back to some of your travels. You decided to join the Peace Corps. Most people who join the Peace Corps do it pretty soon after they get out of college in their 20s. You waited a while.
Yeah, I did.
How did that decision come about, Jessica?
Well, I'll tell you, Eddie and Margaret, I wanted to be in the Peace Corps since I was in high school. Somebody came to speak to us at some assembly, and it was just, I just always wanted to go. But I had never finished college, and you can't get in unless you have a four-year degree. So in my 30s, I finally got that degree, but that was something that I tabled, and I didn't really do anything about until 2005. I did, for the third time, the Artist Way. And in the Artist Way program, in that program, you do a bucket list. And I looked at that, my bucket list, one of the major things on it was I wanted to live in a culture that wasn't my own, and I wanted to learn a foreign language. And I thought, how in the hell can I do that? Well, I could go in the Peace Corps. And I remembered this old dream of mine. So at age 53, I went into the Peace Corps. I was the oldest person in my group and one of the oldest people in the whole country, as Peace Corps volunteers in Morocco. And there began this incredible journey of being there and living in a little walled village of 250 people in a culture that was really different from my own, and just so much learning is the richest experience I've ever had.
What part of Morocco was that in?
It was in south of a city, Agadir. So it was near the Sahara, but not right in the Sahara. So it was just the area felt like and looked like Arizona. And it was, 125 degrees in the summer, and it was 40 degrees or 30-something in the winter, and we had no central heat or air. And I lived very primitively, I'll tell you.
And any regrets about that decision?
Not a one. It was brilliant.
I had a chance to go to Morocco about 15 years ago, and I was in Fez and Marrakesh, and it's amazing. The food was so good, and the people were really sweet.
Oh, they're amazing.
And so they speak both Arabic and French.
And Spanish.
So in the Spanish Morocco.
And three different Berber dialects, one of which I had to learn, and it was very difficult. Very difficult to learn at my age.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So while you were there, you were helping local families, but in your spare time, honing your skills as a writer. You had already been doing some writing?
Yeah, I've written short stories and poems, but I always wanted to write a novel ever since I was a kid. So here I had, we were busy a lot of times, but a lot of times we weren't. And so I was alone. I was the only person in my village or my nearby town that spoke English. So during the week, in between getting to go to another town and seeing some of my other Peace Corps volunteers, I was pretty lonely and pretty alone. So I just started writing.
You had a laptop?
No.
By hand?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Everything was written by hand.
That's hardcore.
It was hardcore.
And was this book created at that time?
It was.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So you started writing it back then.
Yeah. The idea came to me there and everything.
So Making It Up is the title of the book. And three generations of women are bound together by long buried secrets and a history known only to one of them. Part mystery, part coming-of-age revelation, Making It Up weaves an intricate pattern of questions, lies, and betrayal into a puzzle with missing pieces, which, when found, will change the course of a mother and daughter's lives forever.
Yeah.
Any of this autobiographical?
It really isn't. People ask me that, and I really did not want to write a memoir. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can't write about what you don't.
Life.
Yeah, you can't write about what you don't know about.
Yeah,
but and of course, in each of the characters, there's a little bit of me. But it really is it's a novel. Mm-hmm. So it's not my life.
It starts out pretty heavy duty.
Yeah, I get right into it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading the first page, and it's like, whoa, we're not messing around here. I won't do a spoiler alert.
A spoiler, right.
Yeah.
I've heard, Jessica, that many novel writers say that they had the characters living in their heads, and the characters kind of wrote their own story. And the author, you may have had a plan, but the characters kind of took you in another direction. I'm wondering, was that your experience in writing this book?
In some ways, yeah. You know, of course, I would just... I think all creative stuff comes out of a void, you know, that just great mystery, that great what is. And so if you can be quiet, and I had time to be quiet, you know, I walked a lot. And I walked alone a lot. And so as I walked, often I would just get, you know, a name, or because I didn't know what I was going to name any of these people, you know, and you know, I even got like what their astrological signs were, and you know, what ages they were, and you know, what, and kind of the basic outline of the story as mm-hmm. I, you know, walked and thought, and you know, and then scenes would come up.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was really quite a process.
How long did it take you to complete it?
Well, it took. At first, I was goofing around. You know, I had a lot of excuses because, you know, I've heard somebody say, I don't know who said it, but you know, writing. I think it was Joan Didion said something like, "Writing is a hostile act," and it for me, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's like swallowing razor blades to sit down and get something out because I'm such a critic. You know, yeah. I'm such a harsh critic of myself. Mm-hmm. So every line, I would go over it and over and over in my head before I'd even put it down. So then when it finally would come out, then it was out. You know, I mean, I rewrote it 4 times.
Okay.
But
it's kind of excruciating.
Yes, it's very excruciating. And so I procrastinated a lot. And I had a friend in the Peace Corps who basically told me to shut up and start writing. And I actually do give gratitude to her in the front of the book in my dedication, because she really kind of got on me and called me out. You know, mm-hmm. I kept talking about it, but you know, it's like the person on the bar stool that, you know, talks about all this great stuff I'm gonna do, and then you know, never do it. Mm-hmm. So I finally did, and you know. So it was a great experience.
It's good to have a friend like that who can really push you a little bit.
Yeah.
And you talk about just writing. I mean, that's the artist's way. I remember doing morning pages.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, 2 pages you got to fill? You just start
right,
writing.
Just go. Right.
And unfiltered, you just go.
Yep.
That was so hard for me to do because immediately it's like I'm thinking, is this stupid? Does this make any sense?
Right.
You got that little critic, you know.
Oh, yes. It's merciless.
But that's really destructive to creativity, isn't
it? It is. So I finally just had to let that go. You know, and meditation practice, again, kind of helped that. You know, whenever I'd hear that voice, I would just, you know, have to say, okay, you know, there it is again. Thank you for sharing. I'm going to just keep on going now.
How much is that like writing songs?
Well,
a different process?
Yeah,
similar?
I think it's really, I think it's a little different. Yeah. Some of my favorite songwriters, like John Prine, their songs are like 3 minutes, you know, novels in mm-hmm. and of themselves. So, but, you know, for me, you know, songs come in a lot of different ways because there's words and then there's that music. So it's mysterious kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll be walking and I'll just get a rhythm. And then that'll give me like a horn line or something, or it'll give me a bass line. And then that, you know, and then that can, the rhythm then gives me an idea for words. And then, you know, and then sometimes it's the words that come first and then the music. So anyway, it's an interesting
process.
Have
you recorded anything?
Yeah, you can go on my website and listen
okay,
to
well
my
let's,
music.
Let's start giving out some information.
Okay.
Website is?
It's jessicaringle.com.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, very straightforward. And I have, you know, some of my songs on there that I recorded with my dear friend William Charney, and he's gone. And so I've got my songs, I've got some of my poetry, and I've got a little book teaser on there you can go and look at. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and then I also have a Making It Up Facebook page, and it also has, you know, information about the book.
And you have a couple of readings coming up. Talk about those.
Yeah. I've got one on the January the 28th that's full. And a friend is putting that on for me. Lovely Miss Trish. I so much appreciate you. And my good friend Kate Freeman gave me, also did the same thing for me in December, which is really kind. And I really thank both of them and also thank all the good people that came out and supported me. And then I'm going to have another one on February the 25th, and that's Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Asheville Insight Meditation, which is at 175 Weaverville Highway. Suite H. So that's going to be Saturday, February the 25th.
And that would be on your website listed? Yeah. And it's also on the Asheville Insight Meditation website, which is AshevilleMeditation.com.
That's right.
So they can find out about those book readings.
Right.
Do you like doing book readings?
Actually, I've really had a ball. I've only done one, you know, and it was just, it was so great. I mean, people were asking me great questions like you guys are asking, and I really expected the Q&A to just be, you know, in dead air, and instead it was quite different. I mean, people just kept lobbing me great questions, and we had a great dialogue and a good conversation, and actually Kate had to cut us off so she could get people out of her house. It was great.
Boy. So it's a fairly lengthy book,
yeah.
Almost 400 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
How do you know, Jessica, when your story is complete?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, you know, it's kind of what you were saying. The characters kind of let you know. Yeah. And I think, too, there's a great saying, and it's begin with the end in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And try to do that in therapy, try to do that. You know, begin with the end in mind. So I kind of had an idea how it was going to end. I didn't know how we were going to get there. I knew what was going to start off. I kind of had some elements of what I wanted to bring in there. Kind of had an idea that there were going to be how it was going to go. But, you know, all the details and everything were really a surprise, you know, often.
Was writing the book therapeutic for you?
Yeah. You know, the whole Peace Corps experience was therapeutic because I went in there still struggling with my self-concept. I still was struggling with confidence, and I really struggled with a character defect of envy. I really envied those people that were doing these really cool, what I thought was really cool things with their lives. Not that I didn't do some cool things in my life, but I envied people, and I now know that envy comes from just deep dissatisfaction with, you know, the fact that you're not doing what you really want to do. Mm-hmm. So I had always wanted to write that novel. I had always wanted to live in another country, and I, by golly, I did that. And there's something about doing what feeds you and doing what you really are called to do that really transforms your life and transforms your feelings about yourself forever, really.
And what held you back from doing that?
Fear. You know, mm-hmm. Fear. And my drum roll all the time was, I don't have any money. I don't have any money. I don't have enough money. A big belief in I'm not good enough and a belief that there's not enough, you know, really deep-seated belief about that because that was true, you know, early in my life.
But how did you get past that?
Well, by what we were talking about earlier, you know, doing the work, you know, meditating, mm-hmm. Getting to a place of challenging those ideas and then just seeing and just doing, you know, doing.
Mm-hmm. So in the work that you do as a psychotherapist, working with people in early recovery, you have credibility with those that you're working with. How much do you share about your background? How much do they know about what you've been through?
Well, you know, I only share what I feel is helpful to them. You know, what's going to be helpful to them. And I don't use the sessions to save me or to fix me. You know, that would really be awful. But if I feel that it's something that's going to be a benefit to them that they know about me, and I am very upfront about the fact that I'm in recovery. I really think that right off the bat helps people understand that you can relate to them. And sometimes they'll say, well, you know, other people that haven't been through this can't understand me. And then I'll say, well, That's not exactly true, you know, because do you have to, you know, does your heart surgeon have to have heart failure in order to do surgery on you? No. You know, so, you know, people can bring a lot of different aspects to recovery without having gone through it. But I think it does really automatically set a pretty sweet spot, mm-hmm. you know, with people if they know you've been sure. where they've been.
Mm-hmm. But of course, even people who haven't dealt with substance use disorder, they can understand mm-hmm. addiction.
You sure can.
And they can certainly understand pain.
Yeah, you bet. And that's what I try to tell them when they, you know, run that by me and, oh, well, so-and-so is not an addict. They can't help me. No, that's not true, you know.
Yeah. So let's talk about forgiveness. How important is that been for you? To learn how to forgive others in your journey?
Well, it's been absolutely vital, but it is a process, you know. I would never tell somebody that they needed to forgive someone who had really grievously harmed them before they were ready to do it. And I think you have to go through all the feelings, you know, before you can get to forgiveness. I think you really have to go through the grief, the loss, the anger, the rage, all that. Because if you don't, if you try to go from just, you know, this happened to forgiveness, it's like putting wax on a dirty floor. You're just covering up. Or like some people say, a spiritual bypass. You know, it's just not going to be effective. So I always tell people, you know, it's your process, and it's going to be... It's going to look the way it looks for you and not for anybody else.
How did you get to a place of forgiveness?
I got there by finally accepting that I was not to blame for what happened, and also that I didn't need those people to be anything other than what they were.
And these people being...
The people that raised me up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was a number of them, and they were all messed up. And I finally got to a place of understanding that they had been through probably some terrible things themselves, you know, that you know what runs downhill, and that there's intergenerational stuff that goes on. And so there was a beginning of compassion around that. When I was in graduate school, the emphasis was really a lot on the therapist, you know, and their work, you know, what they need to do, you know, their family of origin work. So one of the things I did was I went around and interviewed a lot of the people that were still left. And they're all gone now. But interviewing them all and finding out what their hopes and dreams were. What had they really wanted out of life? You know, what happened? What happened to them? And that helped. Yeah, and then just no longer expecting that my mother was ever going to be a mother, and just letting her just be a person, you know. And then, you know, finding out how to mother myself and finding, you know, other people that could fill in a little bit on that. And all that, you know, it was a lot.
It really is a burden when we cling to these expectations that people act a certain way.
Ooh.
Fulfill a certain
yes.
role.
Oh my God. And
I know that's something, Margaret, you and I have talked about.
Yes. Yeah, in marriage, it would be a really big deal.
Yeah, but just in terms of, you know, parent-child relationships or sibling relationships, you know, I had a friend who told me that, you know, she came to realize that her parents, she kind of came to look at them as very nice older people that she didn't expect to meet her emotional needs.
Right.
And I thought, oh,
what
that's
freedom.
A very interesting
mm-hmm.
way to look at it. And I kind of adopted that mindset
yeah.
myself, too. And it was helpful for me as
yeah.
well.
Mm-hmm. And just looking at, you know, like my mother, for instance, she would never, ever, ever be able to own what she did. She mm-hmm. just couldn't own it. And so, you know, even though she was in recovery, she just couldn't own that. And so I finally had to just get to a place of saying, all right, you and I have different versions of history.
Mm.
And when I got to that, it was just like, okay, you know, I can still have my version. She's going to have her version. And I can just let that go. Mm-hmm. I don't have to, you know, it's like trying to convert somebody, you know, into your spiritual or political beliefs. It's not going to happen. So,
and within the same family, different members of that family have entirely different perceptions of their growing up years and their relationship with their parents. Because we are different people, we do have different relationships, and the stories can be very different.
Very different.
And I think that's what your book is speaking to.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Excuse me. You know, and compassion, you know, just being able to feel compassion for these people who have caused us harm, have done some pretty heinous stuff in some cases. You know, the stories that we hear, Jessica, you know, in the rooms, among people. But to be able to understand that these people are, that did these things were just human beings just like us.
They were.
They wanted the same things that we wanted. They just confused, in pain. But it's hard to get to that place, to see it like that sometimes, doesn't it? It takes a lot of personal work.
And what about forgiveness of yourself?
Yeah,
your
own self-forgiveness.
It's huge. And that's what I really try to work with the people that I'm working with now, you know. It's so important to forgive ourselves for what we didn't do, what we shouldn't have done, what we couldn't have done, you know, all those regrets, you know, and just, you know, letting that go. And that, again, is a process.
Yeah, because I'm sure for many of the people that you work with out there, they come in facing a lot of difficulties. They've created a lot of wreckage. And they feel overwhelmed. There's so much.
There's so much.
How do you help them understand that it is a process and that it is going to take time and that part of the journey is giving themselves a break?
Yeah. Well, a lot of what I try to do is offer people coping skills. Simple, because we don't have them very long. We've only got these people for 2 weeks.
That's it.
It's ridiculous. And so I try to give them coping skills, and I try to help them stay in the moment as much as they can.
So these people are just going through detox, a lot of them, huh?
Not our side.
Not your side.
No. Yeah, they come. They either come from another detox or they come from our detox.
But 2 weeks, I mean.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean,
it's
wow.
ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's our legislature.
System. That's the system. That's the legislature. And we could spend multiple shows talking about this.
And, have me back sometime.
And our conversation we had before we went on air about just the war on drugs, which is really just
has to stop.
The war on people. But staying with the theme of forgiveness, you know, this is a holiday celebrating the life and the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and just thinking about his commitment to nonviolence, there had to be compassion and forgiveness in his heart, hadn't there?
Yeah, and we have to have compassion and forgiveness in our hearts and nonviolence towards ourselves in order to move towards being able to offer that to others.
You know, and thinking about the people that he learned from, like Gandhi, to look at the work that Gandhi did, who seemed incapable of having hatred for the people who were, in some cases, killing Indians.
Yeah, his people.
Who were peacefully protesting for the right of autonomy. And then I think about His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who, despite the fact that the Chinese have taken away his country, murdered over a million people, destroyed temples, destroyed a culture, continue to persecute people, calls them, the Chinese, his brothers. It seems beyond my capacity to have that perspective. But I guess that's why he has a Nobel Peace Prize and I don't.
Right.
Keep working.
Yeah. And then you have Thich Nhat Hanh, of course,
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Right.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But I really, really believe that capacity is inside each one of us to do that. We just have to cultivate it and work with it, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, in the time that we have remaining, you know, what's a message that you'd like to share with people from your journey that's really been important for you?
Well, it's like a part of my song. I've written a song that I want to get out, and in the first part of it says, "Never give up, and keep reaching for the light. Mm. Nothing lasts forever, not even this long night. You are not alone."
We're not alone. Mm-mm. And community, that coming back to community, mm-hmm. that you talked about, that's so important, isn't it?
So important.
Yeah. And I know for myself, one of the problems I dealt with was isolation. And I've learned that's so dangerous. So mm-hmm. finding community. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the program. Jessica Ringel, you can find out more about her work, her songs, her book, Making It Up, at jessicaringel.com.
That's right.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And thanks again to Jessica Ringel for coming in and joining this week and talking about finding forgiveness and compassion for oneself and others. And I want to encourage our listeners to tune in again next week on January 23rd. We're going to be joined by Judy and Roger Miller. And they're going to be talking about recovering relationships, how to build relationships after we both have entered recovery. And Judy and Roger are both licensed professional counselors, and that's going to be an exciting and interesting show as well. So thanks again for joining us. And if you're listening live Monday night, make sure you stay tuned for Russ Wilson and In the Groove.